afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome to the China and the World Seminar Series here at the LAC Fudan Global Public Policy Hub. This event is co-hosted with the LSE Global Health Initiative. Before we get started, I want to remind our audience that if you have questions along the seminar, please could you put it into the Q&A section if you find the Q&A function on your panel, because you cannot really use the chat function. And our coordinator will be monitoring the Q&A session. We have dedicated a Q&A session once our dialogue with our speaker comes to the end. So by the end, we can have some time to answer your questions. Right. So a bit of self-introduction. I'm Dr. Yu Xizhang, a research fellow in the LAC Fudan Global Public Policy Hub. Today, we are delighted to have invited Dr. Yifei Yan to come back to LSE to have this dialogue with me on the topic of social policy development in the post-COVID age in China and BRICS countries, challenges and opportunities. Dr. Yan is a lecturer in public administration and public policy at the Department of Politics and International Relations, University of Southampton. She previously took the role as an LSE fellow in the social policy department here. Yifei's research sits at the intersection of comparative public policy, social policy, and educational studies, with a geographic focus on emerging economies such as China, India, and Brazil. More recently, she works on developing the theoretical framework of policy capacity in the social policy context, and we will be looking at that framework today. Yifei's doctorate examined the governance of government middle schools in Beijing and Delhi, which won the 2019 Best PhD Dissertation Award from the India Public Policy Network, and has been nominated for some other prestigious prizes. You will be able to read this fantastic project soon as a monography with the Routledge Critical Studies in Asia Education series. So watch out for that. And Yifei's research has been published in some internationally excellent journals, such as the Journal of Public Affairs Education, Journal of Comparative Policy Analysis, Teaching Public Administration, and many other places. So please check out Yifei's homepage for details of her wonderful work. Now, without further ado, I would like to hand over to Yifei to share with us some key messages. Build upon your past research on education policy, as well as social policy more broadly in several of the BRICS countries. So what is so specific and why should we care about these countries' social policy development in the post-COVID age? Now, floor is over to you, Yifei.
Yeah, thank you very much for the kind introduction, Yuxi. And I also like to thank you and thank team once again for inviting me back to an LSE event. It just feels hugely exciting to be back, even just virtually. So I think it's all actually also very timely for us to cover this topic, not least because, as you know, that even China nowadays have reverted back, deviated from its long-term dynamic zero policy against the COVID-19. So I think that suggests that China, the BRICS country, and indeed the world at large is currently at a stage of coexisting with the virus. So I think that marks a more mature time for us to think about the future of social policy development in those regions as compared, say, with a year back or so. So as for the key messages that you asked, I think to begin with, there are two things that immediately comes into my mind. So the first thing is that is what I call contextual specificity. So in other words, is to look at and understand the BRICS countries through their individual lives. So the reason why I think that it is important is, well, for those of you who are familiar with the Chinese context, I think you probably heard this term for a very long time in the online discussion called copying homework, right? 抄作业. So kind of suggesting that if the other countries were adopting China's policy at that time, so they should anticipate like a similar level of effectiveness and success. So, well, as we all know, that didn't happen. And indeed, oftentimes, such an approach could be neither feasible nor desirable to take. And so for that, I think my own research also attested to that. So here, the copying of homework wasn't even from one country to another. But in our within country comparison of the two otherwise similar states in Brazil, so we show how the differences in their policy capacity configuration has led to different education system reform trajectories and also the outcomes. So given the success of one particular state called Ceará, and also the role of its flagship program called Literacy at the Right Level, so that has kind of like maybe understandably the thinking of, okay, well, how Ceará's experience might be copied elsewhere in Brazil. So here, the one that made the copy is actually not another region in Brazil, but actually by the federal government. But unfortunately, I think the federal equivalent of that program didn't go so far as the Ceará's program, exactly because the required policy capacity configuration wasn't just available in adequate amount at the federal level. So I think the key takeaway here is that if we are to answer the question today as for how China and the BRICS countries can build back better, so I think the answer definitely has to take into account their idiosyncratic policy trajectories during the pandemic and certainly before the pandemic. So the second message here might sound slightly distant from the first message in a sense that I wish to advocate for putting the BRICS countries also into a global perspective. But the rationale for saying that is, as we know, that even though the exact manifestation of these policy issues and accordingly the solutions might be context specific, but if we think about the challenges these countries face, we can actually see that there's a lot of similarities, right? So for example, I think Yuxi, much of your research focuses on how to deliver healthcare, especially to socioeconomically disadvantaged populations, such as the migrant workers. So that definitely is not only an issue for China, right? But it's also relevant for India, for Brazil, et cetera. Whereas my recent research is prompted by the fact that online education has been a very invaluable alternative to resume the teaching and the learning activities. So as such, how to make online education work has become global challenges as well. So I think this kind of mere fact also means that there would be ample scope for different countries to learn from each other's experience and also the lessons. But I think for that to happen, it actually also requires the continued hard work from us comparative social and public policy researchers in not only understanding what's going on in this country, in these countries, like what kind of policies work and then what failed to work, but also like to understand the delve deeper into the mechanism behind. So I think I'll just start with these two messages and I'm happy to follow up on that.
Fantastic. Thanks for the very short but very rich sort of messages or presentation. I think I really resonate with, when you say the key message in terms of, from the perspective of comparative social policy researcher, we always think about, how can one learn from the other? So it's interconnected world. We have the shared challenges. And we're always looking out to have, sort of policy lessons in a globalized world, but I particularly like your caveat in terms of we need to think about the institutional infrastructures, the capacity, and all the, you know, sort of specifics of the countries we're talking about. I also really resonate with the message of timing, said it's a right time for us to have this dialogue. And I do think now is probably the right time. And hopefully researchers and policymakers alike, they will have a bit more bandwidth to really bring in back the longitudinal dimension and draw some useful lessons. So by time, I think from my perspective, we are not just emphasizing the salience of the issue or whether it's headline worthy, but we really want to contextualize our keyword, right? Our understanding of policy challenges and opportunities into a longer historical period. In a sense, I'm advocating for the revival of historical institutionalism, as many challenges are shaped by stable or even rigid institutions, long-term patterns or paradigms, and quite frequently we deliver effective emergency answers from the knowledge of past successes and failures. For example, for some health systems, for example, the one operating in China, we know that weak primary care capacity due to the long-term bias for offering treatment and care in hospital environment not only make hospitals more subject to being overwhelmed by the waves of pandemic, but it's a waste opportunity for health professionals and health workers in communities to build bandages and a trust with the population they serve while day-to-day, you know, frequent interaction. However, we know that such doctor, patient, or expert public trust is absolutely critical for successful implementation of pandemic policies, for example, vaccine programs. So in short, my message now is the right time to think about social policy and capacity building from the longitudinal perspective that connects before, during, and after COVID, as Yifei rightfully suggested. So talking about capacity building, I know Yifei, much of your work is built around the core concept of policy capacity. So for my own curiosity, but also for our audience, can you just briefly introduce what is policy capacity? How is it different to the more frequently used concepts such as state capacity, right? And how can policy capacity as an analytical tool, how can it help us better understand social policy and developments?
Yeah, thanks, Yuxi. So I think that's an excellent question. So I think, more from the perspective of education policy, situated in my education policy research. So I think the reason why I'm attracted to the idea of policy capacity is, for quite a long while, the discussion, especially in the empirical research in policy, in education policy, has just given out the message of input matters, right? Just in short. So basically testing out whether, building the schools or giving out free textbooks would work to improve the learning outcomes. So I think, largely speaking, so I think the focus and interest on policy capacity matches with a kind of governance turn from arguing input matters to arguing governance, meaning that how the education system is really organized and different interests being coordinated each other. So coordinated with each other. So I think that was my original interest and also the area that I originally intend to understand with regard to the education policy field. And then within the large premises that governance matters, I also noticed that, so the interest in capacity is like has a very long history behind that, right? So with similar ideas, as you mentioned, on like state capacity, and also like can be mentioned like in other different terms, such as administrative capacity, for example, right? So, but the one of the issues with like this, like previous terms or the pictures is that the discussions on capacity is still quite largely fragmented, in a sense that either the concept could just refer to a very narrow set of capacity, or like it can be very broad so as to like encompass almost everything, right? So I think what that is also the moment when I got more attracted to the idea of policy capacity, which was in that seminal paper of Wu, Ramesh, and Howlett, who identified this as a multi-dimensional but also nested concept of a range of skills and resources and competencies and capabilities that is essential for performing the governance functions, right? So I think the reason why that suits my interest in understanding the governance of education policy as well as other social policy sector is that it offers both a quite clear cut but also quite a relevant analytical tool for us to understand, okay, so what really is the capacity that needs to be associated with the different functions in educational governance, right? So that is why, one of my first contributions to this literature is that I applied that theoretical framework just to test out it in a like a single function of education governance, which is the teacher capacity building. So in that comparative study of the teacher capacity building in the government middle schools in Beijing and Delhi, so we figured out that how the differentiated configuration in both sides actually had some outcomes in terms of the teacher training and promotion was actually received by its very target. So building on the findings of that paper, so the Brazilian within country comparison that I mentioned earlier, so is has a wider scope in using the policy capacity framework to explain the diverging trajectories of the reform of the entire education system. So that I think is my two existing or like previous most recent experience with the how the policy capacity framework can be used in understanding social policy development. But having said that, there's still like many gaps that is yet to be filled, right? So for example, the temporality of policy capacity in a sense of asking how does different policy capacity matter over time, right? And also more importantly, right? Given that we know, okay, policy capacity matters, but then a very natural question that comes next is how such capacity can be built in public organizations. So this is actually some ongoing project that I wish to explore both within the in the education policy sector itself, but also beyond that to look at other social policy sectors.
Wonderful. So I read some of your paper that developed the sort of policy capacity framework. I think I really like the concept because the three dimensions actually seems to quite nicely capture several themes from our joint interest. So I think now why don't we just share some of the findings from my from our past research or our knowledge of the received wisdom in the discipline according to the framework of policy capacity. And the caveat is that we're not trying to do a very strict cross-country comparative study here, but it's more like to share some, you know, sort of empiric stories, you know, findings from each of our research and to help our audience to better understand how we could approach the social policy development in BRICS countries, as we said before, during and after COVID. and what might be, you know, what might be the potential places we can develop policy lessons. So I know the policy capacity consists of the analytical capacity, the operationalization capacity, and the political capacity. So if I could just start with giving us some examples of what do you mean by analytical capacity, and you know, how analytical capacity have affected social policy development in Brazil or some other country, and how can we improve that?
Yeah, thanks, Yuxi. I think that's also a very pertinent question for the discussion. So I think, well, as mentioned in the beginning, given that what the policy capacity is a multidimensional and also nested concept. So likewise, when we apply or when we talk about analytical capacity, then definitely that kind of capacity would also be operationalized at different levels, meaning that well, the individual who actually carried out the policy work, and also at the organization level, and last but not least, at the system level as well, right? So I think broadly, well, considering all these different levels together, analytical capacity can be mentioned as something, well, like overall, like within that kind of like culture that advocates for evidence-based policymaking, and then also endeavors to generate and also collect like the relevant information to a particular social policy sector, right? So for example, for the education sector, and when we talk about like the systematical level reform and also the improvement, right? Then definitely it means that, well, even before carrying out the relevant policies and programs and interventions, so the system first would need to like realize, okay, what are the status of the education policy sector and also where the gaps lies, right? So, and also I think here it's also important to realize that whereas some of the stylized effects, such as well, student learning outcomes and also oftentimes the input, right? So these can be measured by quantitative data, so in which you do a survey and something like that. But on the other hand, there's also key informations within the sector that may be better to be using qualitative research methods, right? So for example, in our previous paper on teacher capacity building, I mean, given that the teachers are very recipient of such intervention, then like teachers' perceptions and experience is definitely something that policymakers cannot afford to bypass, right? And likewise, I think for the systematic reform, again, teachers experiencing that, but also like maybe the students and also other stakeholders. So basically, like in order to show the high level of policy capacity, like the system would need to have data infrastructure that is both comprehensive in terms of covering the different aspects of inputs, process, and outputs and outcomes, but also in a multiple and a diverse way of data collection. So I think the reason why this is important for social policy development is like, so that would actually provide the most direct and also the straightforward basis on which the different policy instruments can be utilized and applied.
So just to follow up on the analytical capacity, right? So can you give us some, you know, idea, what are the opportunities and gaps, right, going forward? And analytical capacity for BRICS countries, you know, sort of further improve their analytical capacity. And where are the, let's say, data that is missing, but most important if they want to improve their analytical capacity, but more, you know, sort of educational system more broadly?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Yuxi. So I think when it comes to the opportunities for analytical capacity. I mean, well, the first thing that comes to my mind, and perhaps like applies to many of you guys as well, is to think about the role of technology, right? So how the technology has been an enabler in generating data, like as well as in many other aspects during the pandemic, right? So I think I do agree, and also I personally has experienced how technology has been an enabler here, but I think, well, like it is also worth here for us to ask a follow-up question in terms of analytical capacity of what, right? So I think asking this question would help us like understand in a more comprehensive manner both the potentials and the limitations offered by these kind of technology-enabled analysis. So I think from what I observed, the reason why we can say that technology is an enabler is to see how it has very competently give us many times a broader picture or the more accurate overall picture, either for the education sector, and I think you can tell like in health sector and many other social policy sectors as well. But I think the challenges remain as for eliciting the details beyond such comprehensiveness and also the precision, right? So what do I mean by that? Again, like we can take the example of online education, which is like a prime example of the role of technology as an enabler, right? But then if we think about how is the online education being experienced, especially by the socioeconomically disadvantaged population, right? So I think one research that I noticed that is in the context of India is that for those like poor families that has many, many children, right? But given the limited resources, it means that those families often only had one iPad or one smartphone, right, that has to be shared with those many children. So that often ends up like with, as you probably can guess, like favoring the boys' learning needs, whereas at the cost of girls, right? And I think that such kind of constraints is not only observed in the basic education sector, but even in higher education sector as well, and which is as shown in another research, I think in a coastal region in China that is close to Shanghai. So which is, as you can imagine, like supposedly that's one of the most prosperous regions in China, right? And actually my own research would say that it's not even that, because like for our particular research on online education, well, it's not entirely about the BRICS countries, but we precisely choose the higher education system of Singapore and Hong Kong because you know that they have long been recognized as a leading higher education systems in Asia, if not globally, right? So that is why we wish to find out, like, what is the experiences of teachers and students, for online education during this period, and also see what kind of lessons that they can offer, like maybe for other countries. But actually, to be honest, to our surprise, right, even in these kind of two contexts, the labeling of the young generation as digital natives sounds a little bit optimistic, you know, when nearly half of the students and the teachers surveyed in these two contexts have zero experience with regard to online education before the COVID. So I think, well, coming back to the question of the challenges and opportunities in analytical capacity. So I think definitely we will continue to see the great potential of technology, but on the other hand, so that potential needs to be weighted in a balanced manner in terms of what are the data that it will be very good at producing versus like what kind of extra data that we still need to gather like from alternative means.
Fantastic. I really like how you identify, you know, online education and as a sort of, you know, like the topic of the day as COVID hit and the educational mode largely switched to remote, delivered remote delivery. And that put new challenges. It's really like new challenges and opportunities for generating new data and build up analytical capacity probably previously has been omitted by many systems. And I also resonate, as you said, with the need to capture the lived experience of people who are the marginalized, disadvantaged population. And in your case, that, you know, the first natural question would be, you know, how does such, you know, missing pieces contribute to our understanding of digital poverty or digital inequality in less developed country, emerging economies, but also in more, you know, OECD countries and developed country context alike. In my case, yeah, absolutely, from my research of sort of how China extended effective universal health coverage to the country's large scale 250 million domestic labor migrants, I find the building of analytic capacity and the availability of data that is previously missing played a very important role. For example, historically, we know migrants in China was discriminated as the float population. And there was a rumor that they were, you know, sort of extra birth illegal guerrillas who only fleeded their hometowns and due to, you know, they want to avoid the penalty for illegal extra births. But as many large-scale survey became available, notably the National Dynamic Monitoring Survey of migrant population, which was run between 2009 and 2018 consecutively for 10 years, and which is also representative of China, every province and most municipality. So the researchers, the public, and the authority alike was able to make the statement that migrants migrated mostly for better salaries. They are economic migrants. Their fertility intention and practice and, you know, reality has absolutely no significant difference to the general population. Therefore, with this data and evidence and the analytical capacity due to the investment on survey and research, like the momentum was able to build to change the sort of discriminative stigmatization of migrants, and correlatedly there were you know, sort of new discussion around their welfare deservedness and how to include and extend equal access to welfare system for migrants. So that is one example from my own research in the healthcare sector, but I think it pretty much also speak to the, yeah, to the theme of, you know, the importance of analytical capacity. For our audience who is interested in IFEI had actually already published a fantastic journal article on the theme she just mentioned about sort of, you know, whether teenagers or, you know, the sort of millennium generation, they are really digital native and how well they adapt to online education during COVID. And in terms of, you know, we are gathering new data to build up the analytical capacity. The paper is published in Journal of Public Affairs Education. If maybe you can drop a line in the Q&A section later. So before the end of today, people can check out themselves. So I guess let's move to the second dimension, which is operationalization. Could you also give us a sort of example to sort of help us understand what do you mean in terms of policy capacity? What is the operational dimension? And again, for BRICS countries, what are the opportunities, gaps, and, you know, challenges going forward?
Yeah, I think what to answer that question, I'll just pick up right like after the example that you shared, Yuxi. So I think that like what the story that you have just told is actually a prime example of how analytical or how the building or the accumulation of analytical capacity actually take precedence, but also pave way for the improvement of operational capacity. Right, in the sense that, okay, knowing that or kind of dispelling the myth of migrant workers as like extra burst guerrillas to really like putting them back as like, say, also like human being or fellow citizens that need special care and also like need like welfare coverage. So I think that is a precedent for the government and also policymakers to revise the previous approaches and think about what are the policy instruments, what can be used to cater to the new understanding of these migrant workers and their needs, right? So I think a similar kind of like a success story is also observed in my case study in Brazil, right? So the part of the reason of Seara's successful education policy reform, in addition to its very strong analytical capacity in a sense of understanding the gaps and also the status of the education system from a very comprehensive perspective. So I think the operational capacity, well, in addition to that, but it's also related to that, right? Because the government was able to, well, build from scratch data infrastructure that comprehensively covers what's going on at the classroom level, at the at the school organizational level, and then at the system level, and also across multiple times, right? There's also both like, I think, regular monthly tests or something like that, but also like the beginning of the year as kind of benchmarking, whereas the end of year as kind of taking stock, right? Right. So with this kind of like very comprehensive data collection and data repertoire, so the public the education authorities in Sierra was able to reflect and really react upon those like analytical insights through a combination of different policy instruments, right? So by policy instruments in the education policy sector, the most common type people can think about is regulation, right? So we're regulating on all the different aspects of that is relevant to education policy, and also recent one is probably related to the accountability policy, right? So by like imposing this kind of international tests and also like the domestic tests and also financing. So I think what is quite special with Sierra's case is that it's not like any single policy instrument that matters, but it's the combination of some, and also like not only the traditional policy instruments, right? In terms of, well, there is the financial instruments there, but they also made some innovations on that in the sense that, so the previous, I think the education financing, because it's like a federal rule on that. So that is based, I think, on the number of students, but has nothing to do, I think, with regard to the educational sector performance, right? So what they did, and the innovation that they did is that they scrapped a rule, so there are two things. So originally the weight of the education sector performance, I think, was either the equal with the other two, I think health or environment, or like it's even the lower than the other two. But with this kind of reform, they put the weight of the consideration of the education performance, the top, like the having the heaviest weight in their education financing formula. But not only that, but they also directly linked this with the education sector's performance rather than just like the number of students, like on the probably the input side, right? And the other clever thing that they did is that even so, the formula itself has very heavy weight on the education performance. But the usage of this amount of money, I think, was 25% of the discretion amount or something like that. So that is not exclusive to the education sector. Meaning that, like, if the state or the municipality wants to, spend the money to to health, to environment, to poverty reduction, to any other regions, to any other agenda, you are free to do that. So I think that will also align, helps build political capacity in the sense that not only does it avoided the obstructions on these kind of measures, but also kind of gathers system-wide support because the benefits or the monies accumulated from that money can be used not exclusively to the education sector. So I think that is another success story in terms of how to devise a combination, but also like make innovations with different policy instruments so as to tackle exactly the policy problem identified from the analytical insights.
Wonderful. And I really, I'm grateful. And I think it's great that you mentioned that bear in mind that the three dimensions of policy capacities are highly integrated, as you said, in terms of operationalization capacity, and it's developed from probably the availability of data and the analytical capacity. But as you again said, you know, using financial resources, you know, by assigning more weight to sort of education performance sort of targets in allocating financial resources, inevitably they are also sort of moderating the political incentives of various actors in the system or in the, you know, scenario stakeholders. So we do need to approach the three dimensions from a more integrated perspective. But I also want to give the example in terms of how operationalization or sort of instrument or infrastructure have contributed to the story I started with, like how China extended effective universal health coverage or social health insurance coverage to migrant workers. As we all know, the problem with migrants is they migrate from their hukou place. Everyone probably know about the household registration place where they're allowed to have their social health insurance enrolled. Whereas when they migrate to big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, they often find it's very difficult to get reimbursed. Normally, they have to pay a large sum of deposit to the hospital, maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands. They probably cannot afford the deposit. Then after the treatment, they have to return to their hometown to get it reimbursed with, you know, sort of mysterious unknown amount. However, as China has installed the cross-provincial instant clearing and settlement platform, it's a digital platform for dealing with social health insurances. And now most migrants, in terms of inpatient care, like hospital, if people are in hospitalized, they can normally get the sort of, according to policy, the share, they can get it reimbursed instantly. So they don't not have to pay the majority of the money first from out of pocket, then, you know, sort of a prolonged process to get that reimbursed back in hometown. So basically all the dirty work, heavy lift is done behind the scene between the, you know, the sending place, i.e. the hukou place, social health insurance, and the treatment place, i.e. the big cities. So between these social health insurances funds and the digital technology, i.e. the interprovincial social health insurance clearing and settlement mechanism and digital platform, plays a key role in terms of, you know, allowing, enabling migrants to access their social health insurances. Therefore, China extends the universal health coverage to migrant workers. How does that play out in COVID? Well, we know that at the very beginning of COVID, many people and travelers were actually stranded in their, you know, sort of cities. Either they work or they had a business trip. But as lockdown of Wuhan or other cities, and quickly, you know, in January 2020, the State Council Financial Ministry and the National Health Commission issued the document to say, okay, no matter where you are, you get tested and treated all for free. So actually, but then there was behind the scenes, there was a mechanism to split the medical bill between the sending place insurance and the treatment place sort of insurance. So that means the infrastructure way China developed before COVID actually actively played a role in terms of streamline the financial arrangement to cover the medical bill for treating COVID patients, no matter they are native or they are travelers or they are migrant workers. So this is an example of, you know, sort of if we connect before, during, and after COVID to think about operationalization capacity, I guess this could be served as an example to help people understand how, you know, sort of from the, you know, how this infrastructure might, you know, be useful from past, present, and going forward. Right, I think, lastly, we want to talk about political capacity. We already sort of mentioned political capacity, but I want you to combine, you know, giving example of political capacity. And I think many people probably are sort of interested in the recent political events in Brazil, such as the, you know, sort of mini version of Capitol Hill riot. So can you give us an example, you know, in your own term, of how can we understand political capacity? What are the opportunities, challenges for BRICS countries going forward? And maybe some, you know, some of your observation of the political events going on in Brazil.
Yeah, well, thanks, Yuxi. I think, I'm glad that you mentioned the recent political turmoil in Brazil, which I think, well, like overall, that is an indicator of how complex, to say the least, the political will, or like in terms of the political message can get during the COVID, right? So on the one hand, because some of the political trend that may have already existed before COVID, right? So for example, populism, right? That already existed to different extent, in India and also in Brazil. And also, well, like during COVID, I think what has been accelerated is the increasing lack of trust to the government and or trust to the experts, right? So I think that's probably compared with like the success story that we shared earlier. So on a political dimension, that's probably less promising in terms of like how to accumulate our political capacity in this kind of like very special and unusual times. But then, having said that, I think the area of social policy is probably even more important to ensure that there is continued political capacity for this particular field in the sense of strengthening the political will of treating what improvement of education and also the improvement and universalization of healthcare as continue to be a priority amongst others, right? So I think the reason why this that would mark the political will to be extra important is what we can think about, even just to a limited extent, whether social policy development can serve as a leverage to either just the restoration of trust and also like the or to give a more positive trend of the political stabilization, et cetera, right? But on the other hand, and in addition to political will, I think an equally important matter for political capacity is to ensure that the different interests are well represented, but also like in a coordinated manner, right? The reason why I say so, that is because of the observation of the story of teacher capacity building in China and India at that time. It's because that on the political political capacity dimension, we can see that actually both the government in Beijing and in Delhi has very strong will to treat the basic education and its improvement as a priority, right? But then I think like the difference that we observed on the political capacity dimension is to what extent the different stakeholders' interests are like really taken on board. So in the case of teacher capacity building, then definitely the needs and also the interests of teachers themselves. So I think the difference that we observed in our comparative case in India and China also on this particular dimension also had some influence on ultimately how this initiative that is meant to support the teachers were actually perceived and experienced on the ground.
Great. I think really, yeah, I agree that when we think about political capacity, not just at macro level, you know, like the relationship between state as the public, which is very, very important in terms of trust, you know, compliance, or which could also reflected in, for example, election, but more generally the public appealing towards government policies. But I think I very much agree with you that, you know, political capacity also should be about thinking politically about, you know, the workforce that is devising, delivering social policy and services. We need to bring back the concept of interest quite frankly and, you know, quite positively to think about the reward for, let's say it's actually universal, not just relevant to China, Brazil, but very much so in this country, in the UK. Think about the reward interest of our health workforce. Think about the morale of the NHS staff, and think about, you know, the burnout of health workforce during the COVID, and how can you rebuild, you know, sort of their, how can you treat their interest and represent their interest quite coordinatedly, as Yifei mentioned, and just trying to think about this system, the state itself, politically, the interest, not just in terms of, you know, the old, good old, you know, principal agent model, you know, the politician and the bureaucrats, but at a more grassroots level, we still need to think quite politically. And all in all, you know, if you treat people and think about their interests positively and how you can, you know, what can we do? How can we sort of to try to optimize that? Then there's a larger chance to have a higher political capacity in terms of, you know, even, you know, the insider of the state, their trust in the institution itself. So I think I really like the sort of generalized or slightly broader understanding of political capacity. Well, I think we probably have 5 minutes left for any questions from the audience. And do we have any question now? please, could you, if you are interested, you know, if you have any question, please put in the Q&A box. No? Maybe you can raise your hand just to give us a heads up if you need a few more minutes to type in your question in the Q&A section.
And in the meanwhile, I just took Yuxi's suggestion to dig out the paper and I'll share the link in the...
Okay, I think if there isn't any burning question, but also, you know, you guys can always reach us via our personal webpage or, you know, sort of institutional homepage, and we are very willing to take answers, take questions and give you answers or share some further reading or literature. I think as it comes to Ife just shared, okay, Ife, you have to share in the Q&A section, I think. If you share in the chat, the audience wouldn't be able to see it. So if you drop in the Q&A section, that'd be great. Okay, I think it comes to the end of our time. Please note you can check out more events like this one on the LC Fudan Global Public Policy Hub, as well as the Global Health Initiative website here at LCE. We would like to thank you for coming to today's session, and we would love to keep in touch with you guys as we are largely back to the travel normality, fingers crossed, and the weather looks getting better, and you know, we hope so. We are planning to host some of the seminars offline in person going forward. So please watch out for the space, and I'd love to see you in real life. Have a great day, everyone. Bye. Bye for now. Bye.